August 3rd, 1968, Marshall and his son Eric doing Finnegan's Wake.
Please to think about this for our benefit. In the, like in the Hesitation Waltz, you do a whoop, bum, 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 whoop, dee, dee, dee. Now, upbeat creates a big vacuum.
All right, so we did that one. So we create a new one here. This should be different.
All right. Let me just sit here and talk to you about this. Well, Marshall, yesterday I was given a grant by the National Council on the Arts for a study of the auditory environment of a block-wide band across Manhattan Island. And I wonder if you had any thoughts about that.
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is that in Tokyo, for example, that street numbering is done according to the time when the building was put up and not according to its location at all. In other words, that is a genetic growth idea of location and space rather than our visual blueprint, chronological, or merely sequential visual arrangement of space. Now, what you're saying is that we are getting around to the idea of noticing that we have a total environment, which is necessarily acoustic and not visual. And this is part of the new software world that we are moving into, electrically, the electric circus world. The whole electric environment is a software world of information, and it's totally invisible. And so people are now becoming quite sensitive to the fact that they live in non-visual environments, and politically, socially, psychologically, they take inner trips rather than outer trips. They go to Esalen to sob in bathtubs, and like Alice in Wonderland, sobbing and changing her personality with each tear. This kind of grant that you're talking about is right down the middle as far as this new technology is concerned. But you say you have specifically the assignment to look at a single block?
A block-wide band that's between two streets, the people in area between two streets, from river to river, from basement to penthouse.
I think it would be fascinating to discover the genesis, the stages by which those buildings and that whole neighborhood came into existence. And obviously, steamboat was more important than railway in creating that block. And now that both steamboat and railroad are obsolete, that block is finished as a neighborhood.
Why do you say steamboat was?
Well, big cities, in New York particularly, was created by boat, not by rail. Rail was incidental. New York is an island. All its concepts of space are still insular. Mm-hmm. I never in my life was in an area as auditory in its concept of space as nuclear and discontinuous and unconnected in its sense of space as New York City. The New Yorker has no idea of space as a continuum, and he is insulted if you point out to him that his signs are of no use in getting you from one part of the town to the other.
You know, one example of how electricity has changed people's environment in relation to it is, and its reflection in sound, is the sound of a whole wall of 100 air conditioners on the side of a building. Now, it's changed the seasons for these people. It's changed their being inside. It's changed their social relationships, and it's
changed their space. Because naturally, when you're out of doors in the summer, your idea of space is very different from indoors in the wintertime. Crime steps up in the summer. Why? Space is different, and space is more challenging, more of a frontier. It offers less sense of identity in the summertime than it does in the wintertime. Your sense of identity is upset and challenged by outer space and frontiers of new frontiers, so you become more violent. It has nothing to do with heat. It has to do with the upset of space conditions. The kids in the blocks, of course, the residents in the blocks have no neighborhood because the occupants of the area change so rapidly that nobody knows anybody, and consequently everybody is a stranger, and when strangers live beside strangers, they become very violent. So I said, just like the old West Frontier. The only way to prove who you are or find out who you are is to sock somebody, shoot somebody. Otherwise, you're nobody. So in a fast-moving, fast-changing neighborhood, violence is normal. It's the only form of identity known to people in such areas. A wonderful figure popped up. My son Eric was telling me that he was listening to a program the other day in which it was mentioned that in London, England, a city of comparable size to New York, total violent deaths for 1967 were 38. In the same period in New York, over 600. This means simply that the English people don't move as fast, they don't shift their neighborhood as fast, they know each other better, they have a better sense of identity, and consequently don't feel the need to smash anybody, to kill anybody. The moment you have no identity, the moment your identity is called in question, you fight.
Interesting thing, you talk of an auditory environment, in a sense, and I think the difference between the auditory environment today and the auditory environment of 700 years ago is that the auditory environment today travels at the speed of electricity.
There's an item that you must pick up sometime, Tony, on tape. That is the sound of an old steel-rimmed wagon wheel going down a New York cobble street. Today, in the August 3 New York Times, there's a wonderful item about a Mr. Fite, F-I-T-E, a sculptor who has beautified a junkyard by art. He has taken an old stone quarry and turned it into a beauty spot with magnificent sculptures made out of the quarry itself. The quarries all closed up when the pneumatic tire came in, because the quarries had mainly been concerned with providing curbstones to protect against the smashing off curbs by old horse-drawn vehicles with steel-rimmed wheels. You can imagine that the sounds of a city block before the pneumatic tire were extraordinarily different. We saw a few minutes ago as we came into your house 20 mounted policemen clattering out onto the cement with steel-shod horses. Steel-shod horses on cement are a very strange sound indeed, and yet they have suddenly been discovered as the only effective form of anti-violence.
Well, an interesting thing. You say steel-shod horses. I imagine these horses are going into Central Park where they ride on dirt, whereas the ones that work on concrete most of the time have rubber
shoes. I see. Shoes. That could be. But isn't it odd that the mounted man is so much more effective as a deterrent against violence than the man on foot?
Well, I found when I was doing New York 19, when I worked with a Renault, going around with a low Renault, I had a totally different point of view than a foot higher in a regular car, totally different relation to people.
You also, perhaps saw a sticker on one of those cars, help stamp out tall dogs.
I was just going to say, one of the greatest dangers was Great Dane. And you had to have your window up if a Great Dane came by.
You mean he might raise his leg and let go?
Mistake you for a hydrant.
By the way, that little habit of these critters is to establish identity and environmental boundaries. Every animal, wolves, foxes, dogs, all establish their identity and their boundaries by urination in circles. They mark off their territory. Anybody who invades that territory is going to be in trouble. But a Canadian anthropologist played a silly trick. Who's that? Farley Mowat, People of the Deer Man. He thought he'd try to protect himself by the same method against wolves when he was camping out in an ordinary tent up near the North Pole, as it were. So he urinated all the way around his tent and left the flaps open, no protection at all. And wolves came exactly up to the urine line and no further. They would not cross that line. Well, speaking of environments, you say you
have to do one.
Well, this is a different form of dew, but give every man his due.
You know, when we were kids, we used to go sleigh riding, and there'd be 20 of us going down into the fields, and if one kid had to take a leak, we'd all line up and we'd make designs in the snow. I call it a form of folk art, you know, peeing in the snow.
Yes, it's a strange kind of focusing. And after all, though, you're not a photographer. Have we covered that theme of yours about that block?
I
think it's really a very rich theme. But the stages by which big cities came into existence are worth noticing, because the ship creates big cities' ports. Seaports are big metropolitan areas. Rail centers are big metropolitan areas. Motor cars tear cities to pieces, throwing them, hurling them out into suburban fragments at a distance. The jet plane comes along, leaves the whole thing to rot as a ghetto.
Let me ask you again this question. Do you see any, or what are your thoughts about the fact that now sound travels at the speed of electricity?
And what about your thoughts on the subject of airplanes that now travel faster than sound? At the speed of a bullet, the planes actually exist. And the effect on cities is drastic. It means no more cities. The globe becomes a village in a physical sense.
It's amazing.
City blocks are literally remote, archaeological, ancient entities that need to be studied. People living in cities today need to develop the habits of archaeologists.
Do you mean if I stay here in this...
You have already become a notable archaeologist, Tony, by recording the sounds of this city. You're probably the only person who will enable the posterity to know what the hell it sounded like.
All right, and does that mean that someday there'll just be rooms around me and I'll be here in a little farmyard?
No, what? Yes, you will. They will be farming in this area where we're sitting in the next few years. Just as London Bridge is not falling down but is carefully being dismantled, every stone in New York will be taken down and the ground returned to agriculture within a few decades.
What will they do with this city? Put it up somewhere as an exhibition?
Oh, there's no need for cities anymore. Under these conditions of travel and of communication, the very existence of a congested metropolitan area is meaningless. It's like the commuter who races downtown at great expense and loss of life in order to use the telephone. Electricity decentralizes all the old hardware made cities by centralizing. All the new software, information, electric circuits decentralize. There isn't, as you know in your work, there isn't anything that you cannot have anywhere. You could do this work that you're doing now, you could do it just as well in Tokyo or at the North Pole.
With one exception. Oh, no, and you still could do it that way if you had full frequency lines to anywhere in the world. Then you could do it anywhere, absolutely.
Well, that already exists as far as the American Armed Services are concerned. And the dew line up in Canada is there to protect you against missiles from any part of the world.
Okay.
Let's switch over to... We're going to have ball on this Joyce thing.
Fine.
Let's go fast before John gets here.
Take your seat. No, he's supposed to be here at
11:30. You see, we are supposed to be here at 10:30.
Of course. Would you like a soda or a milk or a tap or...
Sure, grab something with some sugar in it.
What sort of a... Would
you like a beer?
Oh, no, not a beer.
No, I've got me tea. I might have some of that later.
Carl Rock.
Let's race ahead. We've got a massive dose of stuff for you on Finnegan.
Okay. We had a whole bunch of pages last time.
Well, they didn't help. It's better to have a one envelope of heads. You better grab a sheet, a pad, so you can scribble an occasional word on it, Eric.
I don't know, I'll keep in mind.
No, but it's well to have...
I'm an auditory guy.
I know, but the point is when when you are not at a position where you can talk about a particular point, and you want to keep it in mind, well, give him a pencil, give him a pen. And...
Are we on the air already?
Yep.
Oh, well. Sure, and this morning we want to talk about tales of stem and stemmer stone. Tell me tale of stemmer stone.
Tell me.
Now, what's implied in that, me boy? Stemmer stone.
Well, let's see now. On a more pragmatic level, I just finished reading the letters. Joyce wrote someone about this episode. It was about two washerwomen dialoguing across a ford.
Mississippi River, presumably.
And at the end of the tale, they turn into a tree and a stone.
And a stem is a tree, yeah. and it's organic. It has the flow of water, the movement, and organic undulation of water.
At one level, of course, this has a significance for writing, doesn't it?
Cursive writing?
Right. Remember, the Irish alphabet is entirely composed. All the characters are the names of trees.
And this is
a tree language.
Totally,
so this is a stem.
Whereas the Roman alphabet, or the phonetic alphabet, is a bunch of stones, little fragments, all neutral, like bricks.
Short against
the
room.
By the way, that in chapter 11 of Genesis, we're told that all the world spake one language. And the people said, come. Let us make monuments worthy of our greatness. And they made bricks and built vast towers and destroyed the unity of their culture and their language.
Mm-hmm.
You think?
In a way, is what happens to Finnegan, isn't it? He is reduced after the first thunderclap to a hod carrier of bricks.
Big Meister Finnegan.
And the results on him are the same as those of... let's say the Tower of Babel.
On the other hand, Finnegan represents that in another level, the Finn or tribal cycle, to which we now return again.
He's the tribal man, the corporate expression of the tribal man.
Whereas HCE is the same tribal man broken up into little bits.
He's the corporate expression of the public, a group of individuals.
But the public as fragmented by mechanical industry and
all the visual impulses of writing and phonetic literacy.
And congregated into great crowds and great cities. Yeah. Here comes everybody. HCE. And his opposite number is a dear little Anna Liffey Pluribel.
Right, his wife at one level. She's sort of the environmental force.
The complementarity, the complement to HCE, the stone, is the Anna Livia Pluribel. The little ear world of the babbling brook, the gossipacious Anna Liffey.
These are kinetic too, isn't it?
The washers at the ford represent, of course, the idea of the dream world in which all things are scrubbed. And that the river of the collective unconscious...
Sort of the palimpsest of the unconscious and unconscious, isn't it?
Scrubbing and scrubbing by repetition the images of the day.
And it's also, you'll notice, not only dialogue, which allows sort of this scrubbing, and also the hendiadys, which we can get into, but it's gossip, the oral tradition living on.
Yes.
Gossip.
And which is also the tribal world of village interplay and interface, but to which the electric age brings us back so rapidly. Finn again, only this time wide awake.
Interestingly, speaking of bringing back to the tribal, one of the most important words in the section, recall the first thunder, or the first section which announces the return of the tribal, return from the visual to the oral at least. One of the big words there is tribal balbutians.
Ah, balbutians, the stutter.
Yeah, remember, Finnegan was characterized just after his first fall as big Mr. Finnegan of the stuttering hand.
The stuttering hand. In that connection, that would be the fragmented, careful laying of brick upon brick upon brick, whereas Balbutian's, the gossip stutter, is acoustic and totally the complement or opposite. Eh? Well, this kind of division of eye-ear gives you pretty well the whole structure of the wake, doesn't it?
In a way, it's the royal divorce that Joyce talks about all the time. It's the divorce of the senses.
Which occurred with the advent of the written word.
Of the written word.
And the dominance of the visual.
The dominance of the visual, mainly, yeah.
The royal divorce.
The visual off from the others.
And in the case of the royal divorce of Henry VIII, this was the great cleavage between Europe, within Europe, between the old ear culture of the feudal world and the new eye culture of the Renaissance.
The Renaissance, right. Also...
Which, incidentally, gets a nice reversal today where you have...
back to the pastoral.
With the advent of the book, the church became a book religion. Mm-hmm. Whereas today, with the advent of a software electric environment, the church is beginning to mistake the new electric environment for the mystical body itself. As pretending, many priests are so confused that they're merging themselves in this new electric environment as if it were the mystical body.
Well, the description generally accorded the mystical body concept is really a tribal one, isn't it? It's one in which all persons share a level of consciousness, and this, in a way, is the tribal consciousness.
And it's a completely invisible environment, just as our electric one is.
Totally so. Interestingly, just to get back to the wake for a moment and the royal divorce of the senses, you recall Joyce's big metaphor for the initial sensory split occasioned by the first extensions of man was Humpty Dumpty, falling off the wall and fragmenting.
Well, that brings up that role of Vico in his work. Vico, yep. It was, who was it not, who insisted that every extension, every technology, every extension of man's powers, every amplification, every technology was literally a god, small g, mm-hmm. a god in ancient fable and myth, and therefore that every fable and myth was an accurate account of the effects on society and psyche of this new god.
Mm-hmm. Well, isn't, to a large extent, the Old Testament literally a testament to the war against technology?
Apparently, from Cain onward, the Old Testament anathematizes every technology, every extension of man.
They're seeking to remain in the pastoral, aren't they? The shepherd.
Every kind of mechanical or amplified form of technology is anathematized. The golden calf was, of course, money. Yep. The creation of cities, markets, huge enterprise.
Remember, Joyce, he married his markets cheap by fell.
Well, this kind of ear-eye-ear split, which runs right through the wake, is also the east-west split, isn't it? Between, mm-hmm. And Joyce is loaded with their references to that, isn't he?
Yeah, well, he sort of traces it through this progression from the tribal through the east to the west, and there you remain.
The west.
Immediately after the...
the west the shall fall, shake the east awake.
While yet you have the night for morn.
Suggesting that as Western hardware, old technology, hits the east, mm-hmm. it wakes the east out of its tribal dream.
Right.
But in the meantime, our new electric technology is orientalizing us, turning us inward.
Sure.
And
it's also working equally on the old tribal world, just sending them more tribal. Remember, he has this global village concept nailed down several times with phrases like, the herb, it orbs. Heading towards and in away from the centralized concept.
The obvious of that, it plays, works just, you could say the orb, it herbs just as well, couldn't you?
Yeah. Urban and orbal. Another one, orable.
Well, there's another great pair that runs all the way through the wake. That's Shem and Shawn.
Ah, yeah.
Tell me tale of stem or stone, tales of Shem and Shawn. Do these relate to the same themes of stem and stone?
Well, certainly. Shem and Shawn are kind of particularized aspects of the civil mode. While humanity remains in a civilized state prior to its retribalization.
Well, Shem suggests the Hebrew tribal world, yeah. Shawn the Irish tribal world.
Sean is yeah. an Irish.
At one level, but you also have this aspect of the civilized mode in that Shem is the artistic element and Sean the bureaucrat.
The pen, which ties up with the stem and the plume, the pen, plume de montant, etc.
Sean is more, remember he's characterized as a postman of the mind, riding backwards through the night.
Yeah.
The night pages of the wake. But I might say about night.
He's a kind of male, tribal memory. Yeah. The night is the world in which the dirty linen of the day gets washed by repetition and scrubbing. It is also the world of the archetype.
And the dream.
The dream
is closure for.
Whereas the day is the world of the cliché, the visually tied together things.
Right.
And the world of the archetype is the world of the ear, where each item has its own bounds, creates its own condition.
Creates its own space and so on. Yeah.
This
also very important, and this is sort of an implicit metaphor, is the way that Finnegan wakes. He sort of lies dormant in this night world.
Finnegan is the corporate is the corporate man, isn't he? The sleeping giant. The whole of mankind is seen as one
tribal
one figure.
Entity,
The Hebrew thought of the themselves is that the entire Hebrew race is one person.
Yeah, I imagine so.
Well, Finnegan is like that.
Mm-hmm.
The whole of mankind seen as one person, the sleeping giant. The word, by the way, German word for folk is cloud, dream, sleep, corporate dream.
Mm-hmm.
The anthropologists often speak of primitive or pre-literate people as people of the dream, living in a single unified world of archetypes. But this, of course,
in the oral mode, every experience, every happening is an archetypal one. It's always unique. There isn't.
There's no connections.
Our visual sense of repetition, for example,
and connection.
And connection, but repetition too. We regard a repeated thing as
matching.
The same as
matching. Matching instead of making.
They tend to consider it more in a new context each time.
The auditory world is a world of making. The visual world is a world of matching.
Right.
Shem and Sean, Shem the penman, though, has another very odd aspect, doesn't he? He's a phony. Shem is a sham and a low sham.
Shun
the punman. And he's a sham because he is a forger.
Yeah.
He is engaged in making all sorts of fictions.
Remember that young play about Jim the Penman?
Jim the Penman apparently was a play that Joyce was much devoted to. In Jim the Penman, the forger...
He crosses all the boundaries.
He is, by his counterfeiting powers, able to cross every social boundary.
This is where the distinction between Shem and Sean becomes perhaps most vivid, because Sean is a definite classifiable...
A bureaucrat, a very conventional and respectable man.
A solid member of society who won't budge out of his little classification.
Mm. Well, that's another odd aspect of the oral. An oral society is fixed, rigid, unchanging, whereas a visual society with its fragmentation and so on is endlessly restless, stirring, driven onward and onward into every new form.
The burning wood has come to dance a name.
It's odd that that's a complete paradox.
Yeah.
That the oral society should be the most stable, although made of software and the least material of substances, namely sound.
But they're also the most perceptive as compared to.
They are able to see these invisible environments, these things that.
And to program them, to handle them.
Head them off. The Greek word for environment, perivalos, fascinating. It means to hit from all sides at once. When people are hit by a new environment, they are stunned, stoned, stone-aged,
mm-hmm.
and paralyzed in their perception so that they're unable to see this new form at all. What they see is as Alice in Wonderland looking in the mirror and seeing the old world rather than the new one.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes, that was the amazing thing. Joyce, I remember, said, apropos the mirror, I am the greatest engineer in the world. Spick, spook, spokesman of the specturesque salaciousness. Mm-hmm. Why did he say that?
He said, I'm creating the perfect engine. All the engines I know are wrong. This one has only one wheel.
And it is a square...
No spokes, mind you. And it's all square.
A square wheel without spokes, namely the mirror of art. The shield of Perseus, the thing which enables us to carve off the head of the Gorgon of new technologies
fun for all at Finnegan's Wake.
There
isn't anything that he doesn't manage to combine into the highest cultural forms. Fun for all, funeral. Fun for all at Finnegan's Wake. Pop cults and high cults merge as they do in Bali, where they say, we have no art, we do everything as well as possible.
Would either of you be able to explain a little more for me the idea of visual is matching and auditory is making?
Well, certainly. Well, in visual space you have...
E.H. Gombrich has a book on this subject called Art and Illusion.
Yeah.
So it's always... Eric Havelock, similarly, a book called Preface to Plato, in which the same problem is thoroughly explored. But let's explain it right here and now.
Well, you have in the visual these characteristics of fragmentation, repetition, uniformity, linearity.
And the desire to make the inner and the outer correspond.
Right, and also this tendency to consider things as putting inside a space. You have this concept of container and contained and no relation between the two.
The medium and the message is entirely a visual concept. It is
right.
There is no such dichotomy possible for the auditory man.
No, he'd always be considering things in terms of the relationship between the container and the contained, and one as making the other.
Excuse me, one moment.
We'll
can keep talking because
sure.
It's on. Rena just came back from the doctor.
Sure.
Oh, fine.
Well, in the auditory space, there is no content because everything in such space creates the space that it is. And
it creates a unique space in which it alone exists.
And that is archetypal.
And this space is contributed to by the other things which are happening at the same time. So
now,
if it happens again later, it's different.
In that respect, that wonderful metaphor of choice comes up. One world burrowing upon another.
Oh, yeah.
Every world, in an auditory sense, by resonance, burrows into... And tunnels.
And is burrowed into.
Is burrowed into and tunnels into other worlds.
Right.
So that there is an enormous inter-resonance and interface of worlds constantly metamorphosing and creating new things and new ferment.
Now this kind of thing, of course, is not allowed in the visual space where rigid classifications are set up and you just can't cross one of those boundaries.
By the way, this raises a theme that we haven't mentioned at all, and that is the one of identity, which runs all the way through the wake.
Oh, yeah, the Grail Quest, for example.
The problem of who am I? Why do I am, I look, I like, a posse porter piece is a question asked over and over. A posse porter piece is a mash of split peas in porridge-like form, and what happens to private identity under tribal conditions is somewhat like pea soup.
Or to tribal identity under private conditions.
It works both ways. The tribal man becomes a complete mash or mess of porter peas under civilized conditions. The civilized man becomes a complete mash or mesh of, and the word mish means I am.
In Gaelic.
Shakespeare knew that, obviously, and the scholars have never noticed it in Hamlet when he speaks of mishing mal echo. He is using a bad sound or bad echo of something else.
And Misha is the private or the individualized identity. To a large extent, isn't the whole of Hamlet.
Mishing as a quest for identity.
The big famous monologue to be
How can a corporate king be a private person?
Well, this was Lear's problem, too, wasn't it? King Lear.
All of Shakespeare's heroes are up against this problem of being corporate leaders trying to find room for a private personage. Henry V says, what have kings that privates have not too, save ceremony, save general ceremony?
Mm-hmm.
And this is a perpetual, petulant quirk all the way through Shakespeare. How can we sort out the private and the corporate?
He's always, too, playing on the conflicting modes of the auditory and the visual, like in, or as in Othello, for example. And here you recall, too, one of the biggest things that Othello wanted was visual proof.
Yes.
He had nothing to do with rumor. He said, show me.
Yes. His
handkerchief.
He got it. He got his visual proof, and it ruined him.
It ruined him and his whole world.
Well, you know, the entire wake is contained in the echo of one sentence, isn't it?
Yes.
It starts with river run past even atoms.
Which is the middle of a sentence.
And ends with the rest of the sentence.
The beginning.
Which is the beginning of that. Mm-hmm. And speaks of the keys to given.
This too, in a way.
The opening sentence tells about the fall of man and the loss of the keys of heaven. And the last phrase says the keys to given, meaning the all the understanding of all the data in the world are here given, and heaven is given back to man, the keys to given.
This is another form of a square wheel without spokes, isn't it?
Without spooks?
Yeah, without spooks or spokes. The book is sort of the square as a visual pun, and also the wheel, the return, the emanation and return, the recurso of the book itself as a single sentence.
And the recurso itself being the sort of expurgation of the book,
mm-hmm.
the purification of the old technology. With visual man...
If you live by classification...
And look, always looking at things from a fixed position into a vanishing point. That's why Alice goes through the mirror.
And disregarding context.
When you look from a fixed position into a vanishing point, you have a world of 1 degree. The moment you go through the vanishing point, you have auditory space 360 degrees.
The visual guy deals with things one at a time and classifies them one at a time. The auditory mode tends to deal with multi-things simultaneously, multi-levels.
It's the world of puns.
I was going through something this morning, when you talk of a specialist and so forth. Is like the classic definition of the specialist.
Well,
a friend of mine is a doctor, and he's doing a study of skin doctors and their attitude towards work. And he asked this doctor if skin treatment is going to remain a specialty, and listen to his answer.
Breaks out, they stop drugs immediately. They're aware of drug eruptions. They didn't used to be. In short, we'll become more and more specialists in a narrower and narrower field. It'll be enhanced because it'll be narrowed. Because it'll be more refined. We'll always be the need for a dermatologist as there is a need for a hematologist.
Now, this is literally untrue. For example, today any doctor upon graduation is obsolete. His whole training is finished because of the advances that have taken place during his training. Any engineer, speak to any university, they'll tell you, every one of our engineers is obsolete upon the day of graduation. He has spent so much time studying old stuff, the whole world has changed since he began his studies. He's finished.
There's another point, too, that works, and although probably they haven't reached it yet, and this is the one of reversal.
What is the answer to that?
Yes.
Oh, it's interfield study at all times. Instead of studying one thing, you see, specialized at the beginning, instead of starting off in medicine or engineering, you study the whole field from the beginning of all the fields and the interplay. Oh, yeah.
And surprisingly, keep on studying.
Keep on.
You can't separate your study from your work.
Enables you to keep up with the change, surprisingly.
You
can recognize the same pattern of change here, as here. Whereas if you're just in this one field, instead of looking for the pattern, you're going to be after the data.
Then all study becomes a study of history.
Of the present.
A study of the present.
Which is the future of the future. The future of the future is the present.
Well, then education as it is now is a study of history.
Oh, it's RVM. It's a rearview mirror, of course. It's
done by classification.
All classified data. It's like the phone book.
And that's about the use it has to a person once they're out of the educational system. You can't get a job without experience, which means...
Look, we cut you a damn good disc there, Tony. Boy, I'm telling you. Oh, wow. That's a good one.
It's interesting. Picasso says his objective is to look and to show. To look at what I see and to show what I found.
Okay. Picasso is simply... He had the perceptions of a man living in his time, in all spaces at once. Instead of showing you what the eye sees, he showed you what the hand feels and the ear hears.
Showed you several simultaneous
all at once.
It's audible and it's tactile, but it's not visual.
There's a wonderful bit in the morning paper about the guy who beautified a quarry, an abandoned quarry.
Yes. All right,
now notice, that's...
This is an example. Remember the old phrase, help beautify junkyards. Throw something lovely away today. Well, here's a guy who beautified a junkyard. Now, all the quarries were abandoned when the pneumatic tire came in.
Yeah, you've been over this.
Did we tell you that one?
Yes.
But isn't that amazing? But, you see, there is how you throw something lovely away.
But also, didn't the fact of concrete come into the...
That was what was used for curbing, but it was no good for steel tires.
That's right. Steel wheels.
Riverside Church was made from the quarry up near my house.
Yeah, but you cannot build for when you have wood wheels with steel rims. You cannot a cement curb will not hold up.
Well, it's like running a chisel into it every few minutes.
It just snaps off, so it'll only hold up against rubber. So sure, the reinforced concrete came in against the quarry, but as far as curbstones are concerned, which was the main source of the quarry materials. Cement is no good except for the tire.
Yeah.
Yes, they use the steel curbstone.
Right, they do.
Well, John and I'll have a ball, and then we'll be all the way.
Hi.
Good morning, there.
Good morning, there. Johnny.
Sure, it's a broth of a day and for the broth of a lad.
Hi, guys.
Howdy, Zeke.
I'm coming.
Get that wrapper off.
Let's see, man.
Right,
sorry.
Sure. Who's in charge here?
Get this heavy garment off. Right. Down with the glasses.
Oh, I upped my visual intensity and down my tactile potential.